9:00, we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order of the tax relief for pollution control property advisor committee. So it's good to see everybody. It feels almost like a reunion. It's been a while since we've seen each other face to face, so it's good to be here. And everyone is here except Leo Scherer, and I knew he wouldn't be here. His wife had open heart surgery August 26th, so she's better. I talked to him a couple of days ago, but she's still in the hospital, and he's there, understandably. So that's where Leo is, and I'll just go ahead and say for everyone who hears this every time, but it's, I feel obligated to say the public policy for comments is we want to hear from the public, but within a reasonable amount of time. We do want to get through our agenda, not that we have a full agenda today, but there is a limit to how many comments we'll take. And I'll just say any general comments before we get started, anybody on the committee? They usually have no takers on that, but I always want to give that opportunity. All right, we'll go ahead and get an update on the tax relief for our advisory committee, the applicants, and this is just FYI. I don't want to imply that we have a part of appointments or anything, but it's just an FYI.
Sure. Good morning. For the record, I'm Chance Gooden with TCEQ. Before we get started with that, I just wanted to make point that we have one less face in the crowd. I don't know if you noticed, but Tim Reedy is not with us anymore. He is now working the Office of General Counsel. We have a couple new faces. I'd like to introduce Ron Olson and Don Redmond. They're going to be helping us out now in the Prop 2 program, so you'll see them more, and we'll be working with them. We're excited about that. Yes, we have closed the period for the application, and that closed on September 3rd, and we have received enough applications to fill the spots, so that's good news. Some of y'all reapplied, and we have some new applicants, and we are in the process of going through those and reviewing them right now. Once we get done putting all that packet together, of course it goes through the review process, and we're looking to set that for either a December or January agenda before the commissioners to make their decision. So just look out for that.
Can you tell us how many applied?
I think we have 8 additional applications in addition to who those that reapply. I think that's where we are.
Okay. All right. Good. Mm-hmm. Any other updates while I've got you there? Anything else that TCU staff want to share with us before we get going to the other items?
No, I'm just going to stand here for the next item.
Okay. All right. That's fine. House Bill 1897, I think most of us have seen the bill, but if you want to give your interpretation of it.
We talked about that at our last meeting. Basically, we had a House bill passed, 1897, for those of you who don't remember, requiring us to make a final determination within 1 year of application becoming administrative complete. So what that means is once we have everything from the applicant and we issue them that admin completeness letter, we have then 1 year to issue a final determination. So we're working towards doing those things, and just to kind of give you an idea of where what our reviews are looking like for the past couple of years, in 2012, we completed 95% of our reviews within 15 days. I'm sorry, it took 15 days to complete our technical reviews. So that's 95% of those were completed within 16 days. So we don't foresee a problem with that. And in 2011, we completed 75% of ours within 60 days. So to have 365 days, I don't foresee a problem with us completing those applications within that time frame.
How many did you have any applications that did take more than a year?
Well, we all know who those applications are.
Okay. So yeah, just
it's the ones that we still have pending.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. The HRSA applications.
Yeah.
Yeah. So really, and just so you know, this is for anything that will become, that will come in after September 1st of 2014 that will apply to this new rule with reviewing things in a year. So this doesn't deal with anything historical we're currently dealing with now. So the statistics look good for the past couple of years, so we don't foresee a problem with us being able to get those done within that time frame. It's just going to, we're going to be more expedited with getting information back from our folks. We won't have the, if there's some things that we're having questions on back and forth, we'll have to just kind of cut that short and make our determination at that point if we don't get the information that we're needing from our applicants. So that's kind of what's, what will end up happening.
So the process won't drag on.
That's, I think that was what the intent.
It'll terminate, and the applicant will then be able to reapply.
Appeal.
Apparently, yeah. I mean, they would appeal because we'd have to make a final decision.
Right, right.
The appeals have to be done within the year. The question is, if the appeals aren't done within the year, the rules are going to need to do something with that application.
Yeah, you're
granted.
Right. I guess what I'm coming down to is there anything in your opinion that the advisory committee needs to review rules to help implement that?
Not at this point, no.
Okay.
Do we not need to have the rules do something with that application after it's been there for a year and it hasn't been finally disposed of?
Well, that's what we will be doing in our rules. We'll be indicating the time frames that we'll need to make a application deemed complete by the executive director to allow enough time for the process to happen for the appeals process with the office, general counsel office, and chief clerk's office.
So you guys are going to have a package of changes to the rules that will then put that in effect. Then
correct. Yeah,
sounds good.
All right. Anything else on item number 3? Or any other legislation? I'm not aware of any other legislation that affected this program.
Yeah, I hope there's not any other.
Yeah,
I don't
okay.
know. But
all right.
Sorry. Can the legislation that was related to the landfill gas capture and conversion to product, What does that mean? That gave a certain time period for those applicants to come in? That's separate from the program?
Well, I mean, it did pass, but that's out of the purview of this program.
Okay, so you guys don't even review that. That goes to a SOCA.
Yeah, that's a direct statutory exemption, so it goes straight to the chief appraiser.
Okay.
But it's 2 years, and that group, right, that group feels that our current rules are faulty, and we'll come back to the legislature in next session to do something, and they're saying we'll come back if y'all don't fix your rules. And I think I heard, we all were looking at it and going, we're not sure we quite understand what's wrong with the rules. And I'm not sure we as a advisory committee shouldn't think about adopting a resolution or whatever that can be provided to the legislature to let them know at least what this group of a diverse group of stakeholders thinks about that issue. Because it's coming back.
All right. Duly noted. We'll
say that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Uh-huh. I've got a question about the chief. Roland Bieber. The chief appraiser is in charge of value and exemptions. I wonder why we're opening up and allowing the entities to veto a decision made by the chief appraiser.
Was that in the law, right?
Yes.
In the bill that passed?
Yeah, yeah. I don't have a problem in this, but it's opening the door, and now we've got a gray area that's going to open wider. And is, are the entities going to come back and start vetoing values? I'm just putting that out. We're getting on a slippery slope here.
I thought about that, too. And are you going toward, should the advisory committee advise revisions to that going forward? Is it?
I think if, you know, it wouldn't hurt. I think that's something we need to do before the legislature meets again. That door needs to be closed.
Okay.
It either needs to be closed or make sure it doesn't open any further.
Yeah, I mean, this is Mike Nassi here. I mean, that language didn't come from the people I represented, but, you know, it was very narrowly crafted. I think it would be helpful for us to talk about what that narrow purpose was, that it wasn't designed. I mean, legal principle would be that since it narrowly defined when such a effective veto could occur, that silence on other situations would mean that those that such a veto right does not exist.
Yes, I agree with that, and
I'd support that interpretation. This was narrowly crafted to be responsive to some of the folks that were involved that had some concerns about what an appraisal might be able to be authorized to do.
Well, it's right. It did come out of your concern to be able to, or y'all's concern to be able to continue to craft deals out, craft deals with local entities and appraisal districts that might not be consistent with the statutes. I'm not sure I said that right, but different than what the different process than what the statutes contemplated.
Well, I mean, we have an ongoing good relationship with the chief appraisers, and we want the autonomy of the chief appraiser to be preserved. That was the request that the regulated community made. There were other interests. I'm not saying you represented them, Don, but there were other interests at the table that had insisted that that be qualified with the right of a taxing unit to actually review and approve, in this instance, what the chief appraiser agreement would look like. You know, we don't necessarily think that language was necessary, but we were willing to go along in a spirit of compromise with that language. Our most important interest was to preserve the autonomy of the chief appraiser.
And so, for everyone's context here, we're talking about a applicant has not does not have a final determination from TCEQ.
Right.
They don't have an exemption. They file for the exemption at the local, right now, they can file for the, at the local level. And then protest when it's denied. Or they can, or that there was a desire in the in this mismatch of group that was trying to make progress in the legislature. They wanted the ability to sit down with the chief appraiser and come up with a different solution than that process and statute. And the desire by some of the folks at the table was the taxing entities need to be involved in that agreement. So if you follow the statutory procedure, there's no involvement of these of the taxing entities. But if you go to an agreement that is going to go different than the statutory procedure, and that was, I understand your concern on it, but at the time, it was, you know, making sausage.
I understand that. I don't have a problem with this bill, you know, in this context. The problem is, let's look historically. When arbitration first came out, equality wasn't going to be there. ENU wasn't going to be part of the. It's there now. Once that door is open, it's there. The deal with the SOA hearings. They put it out there for, what, five of the larger districts, and now it applies to, what, 70 of us. Once it's there, it becomes, you know, it sounds good, and let's move forward with it. That's my only concern.
Yeah, well, I'll express this, and I can only speak for counties and really my group of counties and not for schools or cities or anyone else, but there's no desire in our group to get any further involved at all in the chief appraiser stuff.
I understand that.
Matter of fact, we get accused of telling y'all what the appraisal should be all the time, and we don't want that. We want you to be independent.
Okay. Any other comments on legislation? We'll move forward to item four then. Chance, I'll let you kick it off.
So item number four talks about the review of every 3 years of the list in Chapter 117, referred to as a Tier 1 table. So for those of you who don't know, we look at that list every 3 years for items that should be added that we've come across over the last 3 years that needs to be added to the Tier 1 table that we've deemed to be 100% pollution control. And then some items that we've come across that need to be taken off. And so we're starting that process along with this rule changes that we're going to be implementing for House Bill 1897. So I guess my call to you is if y'all have ideas, if y'all have things that y'all have seen out there in the industry that you think that need to be pulled off the list or needed to be added to the list or some type of change, we'd like to see those. If you could just write up a kind of a background, a history of what it is that you're experiencing and why, and submit them to the program, we would look at those and incorporate those with our review of the other items that we're looking at. So
I want to clarify something for the record. 1131L says the TCEQ by rule shall update the list adopted under subsection K at least every 3 years, but informally we've extended it beyond K, correct? K being the 18 items on the list.
Yeah, the K list, we adopted that into our, we incorporated that into our rules from the statute. There was no change from that. That is a part of that review as well. But we are looking at items that are on a Tier 1 table that would be deemed at 100%, or we found some information that we're not getting consistent 100% use of that piece of pollution control equipment that we think needs to be pulled off of that table. We went through this exercise 3 years ago with a lot of you guys about some items that we took off and then some items that we added. And then we had some items that were on the table that were indicated a percentage. And so those kind of came off because the Tier 1 table is indicated as 100% pollution control. So if y'all have things that y'all have come across in the past 3 years, please give us a call or write something up about that item and give it to us. We've had discussions in the past 3 years, and we've kept notes about things that y'all have had. So anything new, just let us know.
To what extent do you coordinate with other agencies that also adopt environmental rules? I'm thinking of, Railroad Commission recently updated the rules that go into effect, I think, in January on casing and cementing. I don't know the extent to there are any particular types of equipment in that rule, in the Railroad Commission's rule, on well integrity and casing cementing that, would relate directly to pollution control. But do you have conversations with other agencies that are going through rulemaking?
I mean, not particularly about those rulemaking projects. If we have questions in regards to how they enforce that, we would call on them. But the way we look at our process is by what we receive. So
okay.
That's how we indicate, we have a new group of equipment from these different variety of facilities that we haven't seen in the past. And,
uh-huh.
That's the kind of idea. So that's the driver in a way that would create some different type of applications that we're not used to seeing and
mm-hmm.
how they're used, if they're used 100% or not. But we wouldn't go out and ask them what equipment is involved with this new rule that you
right.
implemented.
But you would encourage
if there's industry
out there that are having to meet new rules, you would certainly.
Again?
If there are industries out there that are having to meet new rules, you would obviously encourage them to let you guys know about it to see if it might qualify for those lists.
Not necessarily. We don't go out and encourage people to
okay.
participate in a program. like I said, they would come in and say and assert, hey, we are required to do these things, and if it's something new, then we would look at that. And when we do the review of the list and we find that these type of items, because of a new rule requirement, need to be added to the list.
So, and that's why we do the 3-year. Would that work the same way in rules of your own agency? If there's legislation passed that required rulemaking,
sure.
It would just sort of depend on the applicants coming forward.
I mean, our program is independent of
all those,
rules that are going. It's just we're the mechanism for them to be able to get relief from those rules.
Chance, I want to clarify something that you said, and kind of I was going back in my mind. Is that quite right? But and that is, your intent was Tier 1 was only 100%. And I do see at the beginning of this that it says is used wholly for pollution control and no marketable product. That's the way it is now. At one time, we had some that were partial. But it's my understanding we removed those because there was not appropriate documentation for that 20% or 50% or whatever it was.
Correct.
So, in other words, there could be some items that we determine that are less than 100% going to Tier 1. If
I
want to
say the discussion we had last time about that, we would not be putting those on there. We would strictly reserve the Tier 1 table for items that were 100%. Is that correct, Ron?
Yes.
As a matter of current policy, I mean, that policy could change. There's no statutory limitation to how y'all implement Tier 1. Fair.
No. There could be another typical type of property that we have a lot of data on now that it could be 40, 50, 60%.
Yeah.
I'm dancing around this. But.
Okay, so that's why I'm asking for information. If y'all have ideas in that sense, and y'all can provide us the data, the consistency, and that percentage, then we will review that for that purpose. But we don't know of anything. That's why we took those things off of that list in the past, because we weren't using them, because they weren't consistently coming in at that 50% or that 60%. They were all getting their own percentages. So that's why we looked at the Tier 1 table as equipment that is used 100%. Make it clear that those items are used for 100%. But again, we don't have any data to support any equipment that is used other than 100%.
But if
to know that all these equipment are coming in at 80%, so we can put that on. We don't have that right now. So
okay,
but you have the ability to.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
All right, so that's food for thought later on, that if we do come up with something that's less than 100%, we would necessarily have to change this language at the beginning of Table 1, of Tier 1, Table 1, which says wholly, so it'd be wholly or partly. And so anyway, I have no direct interest in that right now. I'm just saying what my concern was, if it's something that's very common and it's well established that 30, 40, 50 applications, I don't know a certain number, but adequate data. If it clusters around a certain percentage, then it seems that it should be in a Tier 1 and applicants not have to go through the long, strenuous process every time. That's my point. Okay, any other comments on this? I will say that I will encourage you, those of you who have different contacts, and I'll reach out to the association that I represent and get their ideas on environmental regs that have changed since in the last 3 years, and for any items that need to be added to the list. And I will mention in 1131L, I believe it is. I'll have to look at it again, but it does use the word compelling evidence, so we need compelling evidence to remove it from the list. So just keep that in mind also. So any other, anything we want to, any ideas we want to discuss already?
Is that compelling evidence to remove it from the prior, the expedited consideration list or from the tier one list?
The tier one list. Well,
I don't think that's right.
It does say K, subsection K.
Subsection K, which is just those things that are.
But this same item, at least every 3 years, we've. I haven't found it in the rules anywhere else. Maybe I'm overlooking it. For at least every 3 years is in the rules that applies to tier one. But we're informally applying that there. And I'm just saying that it seems that that same logic would apply to tier one.
Yeah, I don't follow that.
Okay.
I think that the subsection K is very specific.
So we should not not review the list every 3 years, the tier one list?
Well, to be clear, I mean,
that's still required.
The regulations under Chapter 17, right after the tier one table, say the commission shall review and update the tier one table at least once every 3 years. Subsection one, the commission may add an item, dot, dot, dot. Subsection two, the commission may remove an item from the table only if there is compelling evidence to support the conclusion that the item does not render pollution control benefits. That's the whole tier one app.
That's table. In the rules?
That's in the rules. 17.16b2.
Thanks, Mike.
Why'd y'all put that in the rules?
Sorry, 17.14b2.
17.14b2.
The statutory basis is in 11.31k and L.
Referring to the expedited consideration list.
That's your definition of that list. I wouldn't refer to that list as the expedited list. It's one of a number of things that are considered for consideration in the Tier 1 table.
I've picked up that you've wanted to return to the 2007 interpretation.
No. The commission should have the authority to put things on the list. They have not pegged a percentage for any of those items under Tier 1 to date. So they're not on the tier one list.
Okay. And by the way, I'm generally of the opinion when things work well, don't overhaul it. And I'm not looking to overhaul anything, but we are required to at least look at it every 3 years. So we'll go through the process.
Well, that seems wise.
Any other comments? All right, I'll move on to item 5 under old business. And I'll go ahead and stir this, as uncomfortable as it may be, to get a timing update on the HRSC issue. Can we get that?
Yes, we are past our 60-day review time frame since the due date was June 24th. We did receive all the information from, I believe it was 19 different applicants requesting positive use termination on their HRSC equipment. We are getting through the review. We are almost there. With the amount of material that we're looking at and the number of applicants, it's taken us a little longer than our review time, our 60-day review time. So we're almost there. So coming soon?
Soon is encouraging.
Maybe if you could just remind all of us exactly the greater context of that. Just a little more context to where we are in the process.
We can't really give you too much insight on what we are doing with our review, but there's four categories, there's four groups of applicants, and based on when they submitted their application. So we've gotten through two of the groups. So there's two other groups that we're still looking at, and weighing what they requested and the technical information that they provided.
Are you able to characterize the groups to us?
So we have one group that came in. We have the group that received their positive use determinations. And then we have, those are the ones that we're not looking at. Then we have the group that received their positive use determinations, but then they got appealed. And I think those are the 2007 applicants. I think there's six of those. And then we have those that came in before the rule change in 2010. And then we have those groups that were after that date, the group that was after that date, that have to use the cap equation. The group that came in before that rule change, they provided their own cap.
That was the pending.
Is that correct?
That was the pending.
Those
were the pending, or the ones that were tabled in 2008.
The part of the six that that were issued a positive that were on appeal, those also could use their own cap as well.
Right. I guess what I'm asking is, there were certain ones that were received in 2008 that were tabled and not looked at. They didn't receive a positive. They didn't receive
right.
a negative. They were just
right.
Those are the applications before. Okay.
Chance, can you tell us, of the four groups that you just described, which two have you completed your review on?
No, I cannot.
Chance, can you expound on the concept of not of having been able to use their own cap, or what did you mean by that?
Well, the Tier 4 applicants, they were allowed to provide their own cap equation. Now, when we issued
the formula, whether they include a cap or not, right, it is their own proration formula, which may not have been part of the cap.
Yeah, that was part of the request that we asked when we sent out for correspondence for further information. We knew that they had the eligibility to do their own cap, but we also requested that they provide the cap equation for consistency purposes.
For those that supplied their own cap, how do I say this? I assume the TCEQ has the right to completely reject if they disagree with the way they did it.
That's correct.
Okay.
And how would such a process conform to subsection G1 that says that all applications have to be judged under the same rules? Same standards, including specifically subsection K list applications.
Exactly. That's why the review time is taking the time it's taking. We want to be very clear and certain that we're making the right decisions and moving forward in the right manner. So we're looking at those things.
And this is really gets into speculation, I know, but do you envision, this is for our planning, or my planning purposes, do you expect the advisory committee to be pulled in anything to help, for lack of a better word, share the heat with the commissioners that might make a decision on this?
At this time, we do not.
Okay. No. Okay.
So, what is your what is your criteria for an application that can propose its own cap?
Well, that's part of the information that we're looking at. I mean, we have a variety of information that we received, and it takes some time to look at those things to see where they're getting their values from. So at this point, we haven't asked for any additional information, but it's that we have to pull in a lot of expertise to know where those figures are coming from. So,
well, I guess I think I'm asking a procedural rule legal question. It really wouldn't be based upon the application data.
Just sit down.
Don, you give me a hard time this morning. For the record, this is Guy Henry with the Environmental Law Division. We've been working with Chance in the last few months, and mostly it was Tim Reedy. And so as you can tell, we're trying to transition to get some other folks up to speed. But as Chance said, it's taken a lot of time to go through and try to have a uniform set of standards and criteria to review all these different applications that there was different timing, different authorizations for. Sorry.
So.
I hear what you're saying. I appreciate you. I appreciate the work y'all are doing and the size of the task.
It's taken us several years, as you all know.
Thanks.
Sorry.
Any other hot button issues we want to talk about? I don't know. Seriously, any other old business?
Can I make a comment, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
I just want to reiterate sort of what Don said about the captured methane gas exception that showed up in that bill. I hope as a committee we can all agree and perhaps make a statement in the future that it's a bad idea for this Prop 2 program to start creating standalone automatic exceptions outside the realm of this process. Won't go into too much of the detail about how this got passed, but I just think it's bad for industry. It's bad for taxing units. We've got a nice process here where we spend a lot of time debating exactly how we work through these procedures, and if certain groups can just come in, swoop in, and automatically get a statutory exemption, I think it's bad for Prop 2 in the long run, both sides of the table, because what it'll do, it'll just the exceptions will start to swallow up the rule. And so I would echo Don's comment that maybe at a future meeting we negotiate some kind of joint statement that we all believe in this process and don't particularly appreciate folks circumventing it just because they have the political power to do so. So that's my comment.
I hear you, and thanks. My impression is it would go a long way. We all agree Tier 3 has its problems. If we could have a viable alternative to that, I think it would probably help matters significantly. But it's been elusive so far. I'm hopeful with the current evaluations we might have other ideas surface. So, Don, I think you're about to say something.
Yeah, well, at the finish, I'm going to go back and ask if I can ask for y'all's indulgence on one more little teeny question on the Hirsig matter. If you're a appraisal district or a taxing entity out there, what ability do you have that will be affected by the Hirsig decisions? What ability do you have to have access to that process that's going on that application at this point? Do you have I know you can't come and talk to us about the individual things, but if I had to advise one of our members that wanted to know what was going on, what would I tell them they can do to come find out what's going on with that application that impacts them?
At this point, it's a working file. A lot of the information that we are looking at is already public information. I mean, we have that. You can find it at our commissioner's agenda, some of the applicants' applications, in regards to what they're asking for. But if we were to get some requests from different appraisal districts on what it is we're looking at, that would slow down our review process because then we're dealing with information requests. And so all I can ask right now is to be patient. We're just a little over 60 days from when we received the information. This is a very important issue, and we want to make sure that we're doing a thorough review with all the different aspects of it. So I don't foresee years. I don't foresee months. I foresee, weeks when we become more clear the direction we're going and the decision we're making. We'll have to review that up through our process, and then at that point, things will start happening. You'll start seeing notices. So be patient.
Your advice would be to a local government that was like, hey, Don, how do I go over there and find out what they're doing and give our communities?
Well, they certainly can ask for the information. Again,
they have a right to ask for the information if they want, or they can wait, and you would advise, well, just, wait, you'll have a chance.
Just so you know, the information that they request will have to go through a process. It has to go through a legal process and confidentiality and see if it can be retained and all that. And right. So that ties up not only our staff, our attorneys.
Yeah,
and
it's, believe me, we know the hassle, so, right, because we go through it all the time as well. So I'm just trying to make sure I give them the best advice.
Yeah.
Because obviously the HRSGs are big dollar items, right? And there's a lot of interest out there.
Right. Right. Like I said, August 24th was our 60-day mark. So we're working on it.
And I'm not going to, shoot you if you go past this, but do you think we'd hear before the end of the year something?
That is my hope, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What input does anybody have once you come up with final determination?
Oh, well, of course, once we make our determination, it will be sent out, and then
you've got,
course,
public comments.
It's more of the process in which we go to through the appeal process again. It will go before the commissioners. All parties that were involved will come and discuss their concerns on the matter at hand.
Okay.
So everyone will get their letters. Thanks.
Any other old business?
That's direct.
Any new business? All right, we haven't heard from the audience. Any comments from the audience? Please state your name for the record, please.
My name is Tom Countryman. I'm counsel with Norton Rose
Fulbright. Thank you. My name is Tom Countryman. I'm counsel with Norton Rose Fulbright. In the interest of full disclosure, I represent Tenasca Frontier and Borger Energy in the HRSG controversy. It is not my intent today to pose our position in that litigation and that administrative process, but simply to, again, encourage this organization, this body, to rethink Tier 3. Again, full disclosure, both of my clients are in Tier 4. So I am not a Tier 3 applicant, but we do see down the road that there are problems with Tier 3. I know that they've been discussed before, but my clients have asked me to appear here today to encourage you all in the course of the staff change and the rule changes that are inevitably going to be necessary in response to the legislature to once more take a look at Tier 3 and very seriously. Fundamentally, it is our position, and I think a number of industry positions, that Tier 3 is flawed simply because it looks at apples to determine the value of oranges. Specifically, utilizing economic factors, cost old, cost new, MPV, and so on and so forth, does absolutely nothing to determine pollution functionality. The pollution function of a piece of equipment is the sole criteria that the legislature has presented to TCEQ for its evaluation, not economics. And I would remind this group of something that has been said several times, and that is that the appraisal districts in no way are diminished by this because they do have the income approach. Revenues that are generated by a HRSG, i.e. as a result of large efficiency, are captured in the income approach. The problem is that historically the income approach has taken a lot of additional time, and we do understand that and appreciate that. But given this situation, the simple answer, we believe, is for this body and TCEQ to actually focus on pollution function. What was the pollution function of the previous equipment, if any, versus the pollution function of the replacement equipment, HRSG? And simply look at those emissions and come up with a percentage. Again, the revenues associated with increased efficiency will be captured in the income approach to value. And that is something that you gentlemen do on a daily basis. I would remind TCEQ and this body that TCEQ is not charged with the responsibility of developing economic data or evaluating economic data or conducting appraisals. That is appropriately something that is in the realm of the individual appraisers. This body, that body, is charged with the responsibility of protecting the environment. And we believe that an analysis of the Tier 3 formula should convince everyone that that formula has absolutely nothing to do with the charge of TCEQ, because there is not a single factor associated with the current Tier 3 calculation that has anything whatsoever to do with the actual issue of pollution control. You do not measure pollution control by economic factors. They're apples and oranges. So, as we go forward, I know with Mr. Redmond's involvement and Mr. Reedy's departure, all of this is going to be considered in one forum that I'm obviously not interested in getting into today. I'd be happy to discuss it, but that's not the point here. The point here is, where are we going on a going forward basis? Several other specifics, problems with the Tier 3 formula, deserve your attention. Number one, there generally is not any COO. There is no old equipment. And here's the problem with that from a technology standpoint. Nothing can replace a HRSG without changing the fundamental design of the plant from a, from a combined cycle plant to a simple cycle plant. If we are to delete a HRSG, we change the very nature of the entire plant design from a complex cycle, combined cycle, to a simple cycle. And that's a completely different animal. So to suggest that the Tier 3 formula works for HRSGs, it does not. I want to be clear with this body that I'm not here to criticize Tier 3 in every single application. I suspect that it works much better for equipment that has something to do with scrubbing, those kind of things where you add on and just plug and play, as it were. But a HRSG is a fundamentally different piece of equipment for which Tier 3 simply does not work. Secondly, production costs per rule require all raw materials that are associated with the production of whatever byproduct or marketable product there may be. As a matter of course, policy-wise, my clients have been instructed not to consider fuel costs. We think that if we're going to use something of an economic nature, all of the economics have to be brought into the Tier 3 formula. And clearly, fuel costs, without fuel costs, you manufacture no byproduct. The system does not work. And therefore, to suggest that fuel costs should not be deducted as a cost of production is simply economically fallacious if you're going to use an economic model. Also, the HRSGs do not produce electricity. Historically, the focus of this controversy has been on the electricity that is created by the combined cycle plant. HRSGs cannot produce electricity without the addition of a steam turbine. It is the turbine that spins. It is the turbine that generates the electricity. That, I think, has been clearly split now in the process, and we are only looking, I'm only talking now about Herzogs, but Herzogs don't make electricity. So we need to define the byproduct more carefully. When we look at a going-forward formula, when we look for the consistency, Mr. Lee, that you were talking about, we need to be consistent about what are the production costs that we're going to include in this formula. Again, if we're going to look at an economic formula at all, which I would consider still harken back to, we're comparing apples and oranges. I think it's critical that everyone understand and recognize that the current Tier 3 calculation is not a product of legislative enactment, nor is it a requirement of legislative enactment. The legislature specifically provided that this body, corporate, has the opportunity to define and judge pollution control exemptions on a variety of different determinations. The word is plural in the statute under G1. It gives you the option to be somewhat creative. And in this situation, where Tier 3 doesn't work, and we have the opportunity for additional rulemaking, let's get back to the basics. This body looks at pollution control. Emissions are the measurement of pollution control. Value is the measurement of appraisal at a completely different level of this process that is handled by some of these fine gentlemen over here on the side of the room on a daily basis. It's not TCEQ's charge to analyze economic considerations here. That's not found in the statutory mandate. It is in the rules. Our suggestion and our request is that this body encourage this body to relook at Tier 3 and recouch it in terms of emissions control standards. And then whatever percentage you find there, leave it to this chief appraisal districts to determine what value there is in that exemption and or unexempt property that may be partially involved in the production process and therefore not exempt. I thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to present these thoughts.
Thanks. Thanks for coming. Can we ask him some questions?
Sure.
Would you mind?
No, I'm happy to, Mr. Lee.
In your understanding, what is the difference between a Tier 3 and a Tier 4?
In fairness, I think it's been pretty well stated today. The reality is that a Tier 4 applicant was allowed the opportunity to provide TCEQ with its own quote-unquote custom, for lack of a better term, calculation that utilized whatever factors were appropriate to get to a pollution control percentage. Not an economic factor, but a pollution control percentage. In the process of all of that, as everyone here recognizes, there was a fair amount of customization, and so as a result of the desire to get more consistent, Tier 3 was enacted. And I suspect, I haven't done the math on that, I suspect Tier 3 as a pragmatic matter probably works okay for things like scrubbers and other things, but it does not work in application here. And I think we actually, if I were making a pitch here, I would say I think we need to go back to Tier 4, look at that, and then see if we can come up with something more consistent by way of formula. I think our problem here so far is that the formulas have so far been a little bit customized, a little bit problematic in terms of some of the information that's required and so on and so forth. But before we throw the baby out with the bath, let's go back and see if under Tier 4 we can come up with a new formula that actually looks like it ought to look for this application. And I think that's why Tier 4 was originally created, was to allow for that level of discretion, if you will, that every single plant is not going to be the same. Every single piece of equipment does not have the same function. And so consistent with looking at different equipment, you have an overarching way to view it, but it is not outcome determinative. It is something that gives us a guideline, and then we apply it and we make appropriate adjustments or interpretations. But I think there is a formula out there, and I think it's based on emissions control.
Okay. And if you've got a idea on an alternative to the what we're currently doing, even if it's one that applies in certain circumstances and we can define those certain circumstances so that we can have a consistent application overall, I think that's this group has been struggling to find good alternative ideas. So we'd welcome that from you.
Well, at the risk of getting into the litigation, again, speaking only on a going forward basis, I think that if this group looks at the equipment and looks at the Herzig's level of emissions output and then looks at, quote unquote, the equipment without the pollution control effect, which would be either a boiler in a simple cycle or, frankly, just a piece of pipe that replaces the Herzig in a transmission or a vent line, and then looks at that. Again, if I'm stuck with Tier 3, if I'm stuck with economic factors, then I can create, okay, this piece of equipment generates this much in emissions. The Herzig generates this much in emissions. What's the difference? That percentage is the amount of pollution control function that the Herzig provides. And that ends the discussion at this level. Then it's up to the appraisers to say, what's the value of that?
So, if you don't mind, a plant, and I don't know this stuff like you guys do, so forgive me if I say anything stupid here. A combined cycle plant sitting there kicking out kilowatts, and you add a Herzig to it, does the plant kick out more kilowatts than it did before the Herzig?
Well, that, on a very simplistic level, I'm going to answer with a qualified yes because I know where you're going. In reality, you've just changed the entire plant from a simple cycle to a combined cycle, which also creates a lot of technical issues associated with that. But I think that the process that I'm suggesting is that we think a little bit more theoretically than that and that we look at just that piece of equipment. What's the difference between a simple cycle boiler, for example, and a Herzig in terms of the emissions at the end of the plant? If everything else is the same, you do have two different plants at that point by definition. But theoretically, you can still say, okay, the Herzig is what made the change, so what's the emissions here versus the emissions there? Yes, the plant is more efficient, and therefore it will produce either more or the same amount of kilowatts at a lesser fuel cost, for example, because it's more efficient. That aspect is captured in the income approach to value at the property tax assessment level. What this body does is to look only at the exemption per se, and does it reduce emissions? If so, how much? That's the only question. And we've gotten far afield from that by looking at economic factors.
But if we're being theoretical, couldn't I say a utility executive has a decision to make on what kind of power plant to build? He could put it on a wind farm that has no emissions and at 30% capacity factor of 100 megawatts say, well, that's pollution control equipment. And clearly this body does not think that's pollution control equipment. It's a wind plant. So what in the combined cycle power plant, it's being built for an economic reason to produce electricity. The Herzig makes it more efficient, but it doesn't necessarily need the Herzig to meet an environmental regulation, right? The power plant owner could have built a simple cycle plant.
Am I wrong? Could exceed the regulation.
Huh?
It's meet or exceed, so it could exceed the regulation.
If I understand your question, Dr. Reed, sure. Anybody that designs a plant. Oh, did I? I'm sorry.
Anybody that designs a plant has a
I try to keep that a secret. They just put it on.
has a number of considerations that go into the determination of what kind of plant, what size of plant, how's it going to work, what pollution factors are we going to address. So the short answer to your question is, yes, they can make a decision to do whatever. Nowhere is motive addressed in the statutory mandate for pollution control. What is addressed as a mandate is that we support pollution control as a society. Therefore, and that's one of the problems, that was one of the reasons I believe that subsection K was enacted in the first place, because equipment that had a pollution control function was being overlooked when it came time to incentivize that function because it also produced a revenue stream or an additional revenue stream. And I get that. I'm not suggesting that the additional efficiency is necessarily exempt from taxation. That additional revenue stream is taxed specifically under the income approach to value.
Okay.
So it's off the table. The question is, are we going to incentivize the pollution control aspect? If I am building a plant and I can make it more efficient, that's a good economic consideration. If I can further the values of pollution control in the process, that's even better, because that makes people in my local community happier about the nature of the plant. I'm not putting as much junk into the air, and so on and so forth. So the legislature didn't want that functional component of a Herzig or any of the other pollution control equipment listed in subsection L to be overlooked simply because it also contributed to efficiency. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to say something, your comment about the income approach. If you have, say, a coal plant, doesn't have an older one, doesn't have bag house, and you're doing it purely on an income approach, and then you have to add a bag house to scrub the particle emissions, you haven't changed the economics, and you would never need to exempt the bag house because you haven't changed the economics, so you wouldn't be charging anymore for the added property.
If you're doing it on an income approach,
if you're doing, and
you have the numbers to do an income approach.
Right. The other thing is, you can't, most time, you know, companies are not required to provide income information to do tax appraisal. And, yeah, in some cases you can do a pseudo income approach by making some educated guesses, but it's really not. It's a good educated guess. It's not a true outright income appraisal. So I just wanted to point those things out. They're a little bit flawed in what you've said.
If I may respond, Mr. Frizzell.
Yeah,
Chairman. And I don't want to turn this into a debate. We're simply at this point trying to pose. I don't have a perfect solution at this point. We're still working on it with these guys. But I do have what I believe is a better concept. And apropos of your question, there are two factors to that. Number one, does the bag house contribute additional efficiencies that would be captured or viewed in terms of revenue? No. So you don't need the income approach for your baghouse example because you're not adding revenue. You're not trying to capture the taxability of the increased efficiency. So I would submit to you that that example proves this point. In terms of the information that is available, that gets into a realm that is not this body's decision because they're not charged with taxation. You and I can talk about, you know, what information is available at the level of the taxing authorities. But again, if I represent a client who is looking to support an exemption with documentation that is of an economic nature, I, as their lawyer, will make a very clear recommendation that they have a choice to make. Support the economics as requested by the authority, or rethink your exemption. Now, what the clients will do is, again, beyond the realm of theoretical here, but I think that there are answers to the quandaries that you pose. They're thoughtful. They're important to think about, but I think they can be addressed.
Can I ask you a question? Going back to Dr. Reed's example of a wind farm or a wind
get your aspirin and call me in the morning.
Electric facility, under your analysis, would not that facility be entitled to 100% property tax exemption in that the alternative pollutes, the wind facility does not? And doesn't that kind of get us beyond the intent of what Prop 2 was about?
That is a technical question that, honestly, as an attorney, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer, because I think it's specifically related, and I think that's part of what's going on here, that we're trying to work through that and make that determination. I will say this, that if it were to be 100%, it certainly sounds like a good option to put it on Tier 1 table. If it isn't, then I think that there still could be an option where some percentage is achieved and industry and tax folks can all, at least if they're not happy, agree to resolve this issue. I'm not sure that it's a given that if you take out the amount of revenue generated, the economic factor, that necessarily suggests 100% on the exemption side. I think that has to be looked at from a technical perspective. But again, it's a technical question based on emissions control and not revenues, because revenues do not measure pollution.
Mr. Chairman, I've stated this many times before. I agree with Tom, if you did an income approach, none of this would be necessary. There would be no income generated by pollution control. And I even suggest that Stiles in 93, when he put the bill out there, just require income. And if you do that, you don't have to appraise, we don't have to appraise the pollution capturing device to take it off the road. All you're doing is capturing that stuff that's actually producing an income stream. I agree with you on that. It doesn't fit everybody. It doesn't. In today's world, it does not exist. It can't be done. If we gave the option, if you want pollution control, you have to provide income stream to the appraisal district, and the pollution control falls out. Do it with Prop 2, and everything works the way it's supposed to. I agree with you.
What if that was an alternative to the current formulas and processes to go ahead and have your plant valued on an income basis. That way, only the value increase from an income standpoint that a HRSG contributes would get taxed, which is what we're looking for. Why does that not work?
It doesn't work because it doesn't work in the benefit of the company. They're not going to, when they've got this on the table, why would they even consider providing the income stream?
Well, he's suggesting as the way to go.
I'm suggesting that any client would be put to a choice at that point in time. That's as far as I've gone. I don't know, because I haven't done the math, and I don't know what the ramifications are, but I do know what the approaches to value are under USPAP, and I do know what the appraisal districts are charged with the responsibility of doing. If that can be done reasonably and it supports an exemption, sounds to me like we ought to have an exemption. My primary point, though, is that this body is only charged with the responsibility of preserving the environment and supporting incentivizing pollution control. The results of that, the ramifications of that, are to be determined somewhere else, but it's not within this body's charge, and I think because that has shifted a bit in perspective, that's part of the reason for the confusion, the difficulty we're experiencing here. It's a two-step process, and the Tier 3 formula really is trying to do both steps at once.
I've got a point, so I can put this in the form of a question. How do you reconcile that view with the plain language of the statute that charges TCEQ with adopting rules that distinguish the proportion of property that is used to control pollution from the proportion of property that is used to produce goods and services. So there's clearly an economic component. And TCEQ is charged to figure out what is producing goods and services, what proportion is produces goods and services, and what proportion is pollution control. And that, I think, is the genesis of Tier 3.
I think by distinguishing, quote-unquote, distinguishing what is pollution control, let's just pick a number here just to talk about it. Let's say we have a piece of equipment, and even whatever equipment it is, and it has a 40% pollution control functionality to it. 60% is efficiency, revenue generating, all of that stuff. Then that 40% determination would be what TCEQ renders. End of story. Then it goes to the appraisal district, and the appraisal district says, okay, 40% is pollution control exemption. What's the value of the remaining 60%? And they can use cost or income or sales comparison approach, consider all three and pick the best or pick an amalgamation of those.
Well, we all agree with that. It's coming up with what part's 40%. How do you determine the 40-60?
Yeah, but that's what we're doing now, right? I mean, that's what the Tier 3
you
does.
You don't. I'm sorry, I apologize, Ms. Lane. You don't determine what part. That's what the TCEQ is uniquely tasked with the opportunity of doing, and I would say
I didn't mean me personally. I meant, I don't know
if you were talking as a tax authority or as a member of this committee. I'm
sorry. As a member of this committee, the TCEQ, the problem is coming up with an effective way to come up with a 40% or 60%,
sure,
or whatever.
And again, I think you do that
and
by
we emissions. Agree with you. It's just how do you determine that? It's,
I think you
difficult.
Do that by an emissions control ratio that looks at the amount of emissions before and after. Let's do it. Let's make it real easy so I don't get tangled up in what is there replacement equipment or not? Is there COO or not? If I can construct a plant that operates at the same level of kilowatts that doesn't have a Herzig, and compare the emission standard to the same plant that does have a Herzing and generates the same amount of kilowatts, then the emissions differential is the pollution control percentage.
Well, I don't know. You might have the fact that it costs less to build one of those plants as opposed to the other. That makes a difference.
Again, that's an economic factor that has nothing to do with pollution control function.
Couldn't that formula you just talked about produce 100% exemption for something that produces more widgets?
Yeah, exactly. It would.
So doesn't it? I mean, it just conceptually fails, doesn't it?
Honestly, if we're talking widgets and so forth, I'm honestly not capable of responding to that.
Kilowatt hours, then.
Theoretically.
Wouldn't that formula theoretically produce a 100% exemption for something that produces more electricity?
Well, okay, if you're producing more electricity, now you've changed a bunch of the parameters. My position would be, remember what I said, same plant kilowatts with and without Herzig. It will require, if you will, a hypothetical base plant, a hypothetical, in this case, simple cycle plant that makes X number of kilowatts. Then we put a Herzig plant beside it that also makes X kilowatts, and we compare the emissions between the two plants. The level of reduction is the level of pollution control function, added pollution control function of the Herzig.
So this sounds to me like the discussion we had a long time ago when we got into really getting a lot of this, because what we had was we had gas burners with smokestacks and scrubbers on top, right? And we knew to exempt the scrubber, right? And then we replaced it with an electric burner that had zero emissions, and the claim was that's 100% pollution control device, yet it's 100% necessary also to produce the goods and service. How can that be 100% pollution control? And it seems you're saying focus only on the emissions and the difference in emissions,
to determine the percentage that is pollution control versus production, you get to these, you get to conclusions that make no sense. And that's the problem I'm having with you. I really appreciate you coming and sharing ideas, because this committee is struggling with ideas. I don't think anyone on this committee has said, hey, we think that the current formulas are, you know, are perfect. No one on this committee has said that. We have all said we'd love to find things that work better, and we're willing to look at an increasing complexity where you have multiple different options for defined situations. But we've not been able to, amongst this group, come up with something that works better. But I'm suggesting that your suggestion is one we've really been through before, and it produces results that don't comply with the statute, in our view, and don't comply with the intent, which is that if I'm going to add a new electric plant, right, and I'm going to produce kilowatt hours with it, there's got to be taxable value there.
And I would
if there's zero emissions.
And I would not argue with you about that. Here's the thing. If you can divide out what – divorcing ourselves from Herzig's just for a second, just into basic concepts. If I can take a piece of equipment and it has a dual function, one, it's pollution control. One, it generates efficiency revenues, byproduct, marketable product, whatever. And I can say, all right, subpart A of that piece of equipment, the pollution control function, is exempt from taxation because it's pollution control. By definition, it should be exempt, all right? But subpart B of that property is its revenue-generating capabilities. The revenues are not tax-exempt. They are taxed on the basis of the process of an income approach. So what I think has been missed previously is that concept. Pollution control is always 100% exempt. As a pragmatic matter, if it is pollution control, it's 100% exempt. The problem is that we've not made a clear and concise delineation dividing the piece of property into its two separate functions and recognizing that subpart B, i.e. revenue generation, is dealt with on a completely different paradigm, if you will, of income approach taxation. It's the product of the pollution control is reduced emissions. Part A of that piece of equipment is always 100% exempt. What is that 100% exemption to the whole? That is determined on the revenue side and the income side at a different level by different organizations and entities. Does that make sense?
Well, you know,
I just think that part of it hadn't been captured very
But you need to have been here longer and seen some.
One of the things,
let's say you have a piece of pollution control equipment that does what you say, it increases revenue. But let's say it adds so much revenue in 1 year, it pays for itself. And something that already pays for itself, why would we give a property tax exemption to it? As from now on, it's going to be producing revenue. It makes no sense to the spirit of the statute to provide relief for somebody having to spend money to do pollution control.
It was my intent to present comments, not to debate with you, Mr. Frizzell. I would only respond that I believe the legislative mandate is incentivize pollution control, and the taxability issue is resolved at the level of the taxing authority, not at the level of TCEQ. So, I think your question is a valid question, but I don't think it's a question that this body is charged with the responsibility of answering. I think it's a question that has to be addressed at the appraisal level after the exemption has been established.
And Tom, I'm not necessarily trying to bail you out, but if we think this is a...
I, I'm not looking to be bailed.
Okay. If we think this is useful to continue, fine. We certainly welcome your ideas. I've heard vaguely from Hersick people saying they have ideas that they can't talk about or whatever, but that's why I'm hopeful something could come out of it that we use. Not that's perfect. I suspect we won't get a perfect formula or formulas. We might have more than one option. But I'm hoping we get something better.
Well, Mr. Frizzell makes a very valid point. I haven't been in this game for a long time, like all of you have. And by definition, I absolutely think you all are a lot smarter and a lot wiser in all of this. But I think that, and my clients think...
Could you call me doctor again?
I think it is incumbent on perhaps the new guys to come in and say...
Fresh ideas are good.
And if it's not a fresh idea, I apologize.
Fresh eyes and fresh looks are good. And I think some comments you've made to me sound intriguing, but I think it's up to the appraisal chiefs and the taxpayers to really weigh in on that. And I'm hearing something that sounds to me like it says, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But I don't hear that it's something that's been embraced maybe from a taxpayer standpoint of saying, yeah, we're willing to say the current formula we don't think works well for us. We're willing to have this entire thing valued. We're willing to have this stuff valued on an income basis, and we will make that data available so that it can be done. I don't hear that as maybe being embraced, but maybe you'd suggest to me that it could be or is as an option.
I don't mind responding to that, and it's probably no surprise to Roland that you could give the exact data, income data, to different appraisers, whether on the government side or the business side, and you would have a variety of answers. And so, and part of it is proprietary. Actual income information is often proprietary. But if you could provide it to it, there's often, I'll just say, certain individuals that industry does not necessarily trust them to make an adequate appraisal. They just don't trust them. They're concerned it could be twisted because some of us have been burned in the past. And in all fairness, there are good and bad on the government side and the industry side. So I'm quick to say that. But there's not a trust if everyone would use the income information accurately. And secondly, our management are reluctant to provide it because we've experienced certain litigation of certain taxpayers that have, in disclosure, have gotten information that's proprietary, and we don't want to get it released. So that's some of our perspective.
Yeah, some of the difficulty of trying to go to that process.
Right.
But that would be the industry question that Tom is purporting you have to make.
I will say, ideally, if I'm going on a limb too much here, that the income approach would typically account for that, because police control not just generally has zero value, it often has negative value because it increases the cost of production, which decreases your income, cash flow. So, in theory, we don't need Prop 2, but that's a theory. In reality, we do.
In a perfect world, you would not need Prop 2.
Right.
It was industry's testimony in 1991 that the constitutional amendment in the statute would not be necessary if appraisal districts were doing their jobs right. That was testimony at the time.
From industry?
Yeah. And I'm, so theoretically, right, it was saying, look, we never should have our taxes increased by adding non-productive
right
stuff.
It's the way industry views it, it's an unfunded mandate.
Right.
Government gets unfunded mandate. This is our unfunded mandate.
And that's part of the reason why we supported it in 1991, was under that concept, right? Of course, we also We also saw it as an agreement that I think we've tried to work through and live up to, that we're going to do our best to not tax the unproductive pollution control property, but we're not going to exempt the productive property. That as the economy expands and we build and we generate more kilowatts and more kilowatt hours for our people, we're going to tax the production of those kilowatt hours. And that's what we're trying to draw the line on, and you know that. I'm not telling you anything new.
No, I appreciate it, and I realize that it is not my place to engage in this debate in front of this body, and it certainly is not my intent to start a problem or commit to the industry, make a commitment on industry, or make a commitment for the tax appraisal districts or anything else. I'm just trying to suggest that there is a different way, or there at least might be a different way to think about this than has been thought of before. If my comments have furthered the process, stirred some gray cells, and induced a little more creativity into the process, then great. And if not, I have failed in my mission, and I sincerely apologize to this body. But I do think, in closing, that it is fundamentally, logically inconsistent and inappropriate to measure pollution functionality by economic measures. That's just apples and oranges, and until we get over that hump and at least can agree that we measure pollution control function, or we measure pollution control function by emissions control, we're never going to get there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. We appreciate the dialogue.
Thanks. I think your mission has been successful.
I appreciate it.
Okay, he was the first on our list from the audience. Anyone else want to follow? No pressure at all, but you're welcome to.
On a different subject,
yes.
Do we have another meeting for this year?
Yes. I will try to schedule it before the holidays, by the way. I'll send you a note.
Well, I was about to suggest, if unless we have sufficient topics on the agenda, that we do another phone call. But that's just a suggestion.
We'll see what comes out of it. Is maybe I'm overly optimistic that there could be some Herzig news come out in a few weeks, as
okay.
It says. So that could be something that's useful for us. But we'll monitor that. All right. Any other comments? All right. Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
We have a motion to adjourn and a second. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. We are adjourned at 11:28. Thank you for coming.
You have to sit there forever.
Good to see you again.
Good weekend.
Thank you, sir. Try to stay cool.
How you doing?
Good to see you.
How are you?
Yeah, now I'm happy.